From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. With 1992 just a few days away, we ask two Fresh Air critics to look back at 1991. Rock critic Ken Tucker picks his favorite records of the year and plays them for us, and TV critic David Bianculli looks at some of the highs and lows of the past year on TV. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews a new book and a new photography show about the New York City subways. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The day after Mikhail Gorbachev resigned as president of the Soviet Union, several countries around the world have recognized the Russian Republic and many of the other 10 republics now making up the Commonwealth of Independent States. NPR's Suni Khalid reports.
Less than 24 hours after the red, white, and blue flag of the new Russian Federation was hoisted over the Kremlin, a tidal wave of diplomatic recognition poured in from around the world. The European community today joined the United States in granting diplomatic recognition to Russia, Armenia, and Ukraine. Individual European countries also prepared to recognize some of the 8 other republics. Among other nations recognizing Russia today were Egypt, India, Israel, Iran, and Nigeria. Japan said it would recognize Russia tomorrow. Among the few remaining communist countries, Cuba and China said they would also recognize the Russian Federation, although each criticized changes in the former Soviet Union. I'm Suni Khalid in Washington.
The foreign minister of the former Soviet Republic of Georgia has accused Secretary of State James Baker of encouraging political violence in the republic. The accusation came in the form of a letter from Foreign Minister Mourmon Omanidze, released by Georgia's Information Office in Washington. It refers to a speech that Baker made earlier this month, suggesting that Georgia had replaced its communist government with an authoritarian one that's undeserving of U.S. support. Those remarks were widely broadcast by the Voice of America's Georgian Language Service. Authorities in the Indian state of Punjab say Sikh guerrillas allegedly boarded a train and shot at least 47 passengers to death. Tension's been high in Punjab, where Indian troops were given tough new powers last month to deal with Sikh separatists. Mark Tully filed this report for the BBC.
According to the police, the train was traveling down a branch line from Ludhiana to Ferozpur after dark, when the communication cord was pulled. 4 young Sikhs had boarded the train at the start of its journey, and they were joined by 6 others. They're reported to have separated the Hindu passengers from the Sikhs before they opened fire with AK-47 rifles. Almost all the dead were Hindus. This is the latest of a series of killings and bomb explosions, most of which have occurred outside Punjab and appear to be aimed at discrediting the government's claim that the deployment of the army has contained the Sikh separatist violence. The Sikh separatists also clearly hope that incidents like this attack on the train will prevent the government fulfilling its commitment to hold elections to the Punjab State Assembly within the next 2 months.
Mark Tully reporting. There was heavy rain and snow reported today in Texas, already devastated by floods that have killed at least 15 people. Houston reported an inch of rain and 2 inches of snow fell over northwest Texas. On Wall Street today, the Dow Industrials gained nearly 32 points to finish the day at 3,082. This is NPR News. The kidnappers of 2 German hostages in Lebanon said today that they will not release their captives until 2 Shiite Muslim brothers are freed from a German prison. The announcement came in a statement from a group calling itself the Holy Warriors for Freedom, along with a videotape showing hostages Heinrich Strubich and Thomas Kempter. The 2 men are German relief workers who were captured in May of 1989. The kidnappers are believed to be family members of Mohammed Ali Hamadi and Abbas Hamadi, 2 brothers who were convicted of committing separate terrorist acts. The recession is having an impact on higher education, but the news isn't all bad. A new report says that enrollments are up at the less expensive community and junior colleges. Gwendolyn Glenn has more.
A survey conducted by the American Council on Education shows enrollment at most community and junior colleges has increased between 3% and 6% in the past year. An exception is Louisiana, which experienced a 21% rise. Of the 15 states studied in the report, only Connecticut showed a decline, attributed to a drop in the number of high school graduates in that state. The recession has played a role in the increased demand for junior and community colleges. Experts say out-of-work professionals and students of parents who are unemployed are providing the bulk of the increase. These schools are usually conveniently located within communities and are less costly. As to four-year colleges, slight gains are reported, causing those with strained budgets to tighten entrance requirements and impose admittance caps. For National Public Radio, I'm Gwendolyn Glenn in Washington.
The post-Christmas shopping season got off to a busy start today as retailers tried to save what was left of a disappointing December. Many stores offered extra discounts and some even offered special prices for shoppers who made a purchase by this morning. Analysts have predicted that overall sales for this December won't be much different from last year, when shopping was depressed by the prospects of war in the Persian Gulf. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Every year at this time, we ask our rock critic, Ken Tucker, to put together a list of his favorite records of the year. Ken is with us to tell us about his picks and to play them. But first, let's see what Ken thinks of the most hyped record of late 1991. And the record industry has certainly been hoping that we'd all get really excited about Michael Jackson's new record. What do you think of it?
Well, I think it's pretty mediocre. I think that song, Black or White, is in fact the best song on the album. I mean, Michael Jackson is smart enough to have made that the first single off the album, but I find this whole phenomenon of dangerous pretty pathetic. The fact that Michael Jackson has to advertise himself as being dangerous, that we don't know that anymore. And I think that this whole sort of trumped up controversy about the video that premiered was shown after The Simpsons about a month ago.
About him touching himself?
Yeah, I mean, it was. I mean, my family and I, we tuned in The Simpsons and then we watched this video, and it was kind of embarrassing to have to explain to my kids, you know, why Michael Jackson felt it necessary to reassure himself that his crotch was still in the proper place. But, you know, it's kind of a trumped-up controversy, I think, and it's kind of sad. I mean, unlike Macaulay Culkin's parents, I wouldn't let my kids within 5 feet of Michael Jackson these days, not because he's dangerous, but because he's so depressing. You know, he seems to have lost touch with his real instincts about what good, adventurous pop music can be. I mean, he's a man of enormous talent who has kind of withdrawn from the world and from pop culture, I think.
Teddy Riley, who's a producer that I know you really like a lot, produced some of the tracks
about
on Michael Jackson's record. What, do you think those tracks are good?
They're pretty good, but they're just sort of standard Teddy Riley. Teddy Riley works with a group called Guy. I mean, if you just heard these tracks without Michael Jackson's vocals, you'd think it was a Guy record. So just that alone, I mean, this was supposed to be Michael Jackson's big move away from his mentor, Quincy Jones, and yet he found no style of his own. He broke no new ground. He, in fact, seemed to think that he had to go to someone like Teddy Riley, who's established as himself as a hit maker, and kind of insert himself into someone else's style rather than going on his own nerve.
You know, it almost seems that he sends his body out to the laboratory and his music out to the production studio, but he's not really actively controlling either.
It's true. I mean, he's an artist who's really dissociated himself from his own instincts, I think.
Well, enough with Michael Jackson.
We've taken care of him.
Yeah. So are there a couple of trends from 1991 that you'd want to isolate for us?
Well, I think in a sense that the year comes down to phenomenons of two different records. One is a Seattle band called Nirvana, which put out a record called Nevermind. And the other is the enormous success of Garth Brooks and the general kind of popularity of country music. I think the pop year kind of centers around those two events.
So Nirvana, let's start with that. That's in the hard rock.
That's right. I mean, if you listen to you know, record companies and stuff, the true hard rock event was supposed to be Guns N' Roses and the you know, historic release of their double two album Use Your Illusion. I found this a terrible disappointment, this release. I think Guns N' Roses is really overhyped.
For our listeners who don't know them, they're what, a big heavy metal band?
Yeah, very big hard rock heavy metal, led by a lead singer named Axl Rose, who's supposed to be, you know, the most daring, outrageous, rebellious guy in rock, who's actually a guy who just sort of keeps his fans waiting for 2 hours before he starts a show and throws temper tantrums and screams a lot. Which I say with complete confidence that I'm not going to be dismissed as an old fogey, because Nirvana is every bit as loud and rude and as Guns N' Roses. But I think there's a lot more thought behind the music. I think it's really interesting music. I also think that the reason this record is a phenomenon is because it's a record that, without any of the advance hype that Guns N' Roses has had, landed in the top 10, is now in the top 5 as we speak. And it's a true word-of-mouth hit at a time when those things simply don't happen anymore. I mean, this record had no advertising. The previous records that this band had released were on a tiny label called Sub Pop. There was just no reason for this record to have the success it's had, except for the fact that it's extremely good.
Gee, it's kind of inspirational, isn't it?
That's right. It is. It's the inspirational story of the year.
What would you like to play for us from it?
I'd like to play a cut called In Bloom. The leader of Nirvana is the singer and guitarist named Kurt Cobain. And what I really like about this band is the way they kind of express this anger of kids being bored and feeling kind of hopelessness and this kind of rootlessness. I think a lot of these, you know, documentaries you see on TV about the hopelessness of youth, I mean, it adds a lot of flesh and emotion to that kind, those kinds of feelings, without just simply being an example of it. I think that's real art made of these kinds of feelings that kids, I mean, half the time I don't know what he's saying, but the emotion I get from Nirvana is in that kind of grain of Kurt Cobain's voice and that kind of blur that he makes out of his guitar and his voice, which I think is, it's really, really effective.
You know what I find interesting? The way sometimes a lot of the noise and instruments lay out and it almost becomes an acoustic-sounding record.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's a lot of that in there. And I just like the way the voice and the guitar sort of merge together to form one sound.
Ken Tucker is with us, and he's playing for us some of his favorite records of 1991. You had said before that you thought one of the big stories of the year was the commercial breakthrough of country music.
Yes, and in particular with Garth Brooks, who's now sold more than 4 million copies of this new album of his called Rope in the Wind. I don't happen to think that that Garth Brooks record is a particularly good country record, but it certainly is a big symbol of how much country has progressed over the past year commercially.
What's responsible for that?
Well, I think it's because there are an awful lot of people out there who still want to buy records, but who are alienated from the Guns N' Roses of this world, who don't like what they hear of rap this year, which I think in general rap hasn't been as inventive. And people for whom, you know, Joni Mitchell and James Taylor don't put out albums often enough. and want something tuneful, want to hear melodies, want to hear lyrics. And so I think that it's country music this year has taken the place of middle-of-the-road pop. And so I think that someone like Garth Brooks can kind of slip through those cracks and appeal to that audience. But what I think that the significance of this is that as the country audience expands, as the industry gets bigger, it leaves room for more and more individualistic and eccentric voices to pop through. And one of the records that I really liked a lot, which really wasn't played much on country radio, but the mere fact that it got onto a major label, MCA, is Marty Brown, who put out his first album called High and Dry, which I think is a really terrific, hardcore country record Marty Brown just strikes me as somebody who's a star waiting to happen, and in the present atmosphere, I see no reason why over the next year or so that couldn't happen.
What are you going to play for us?
A really terrific song called Every Now and Then.
Did he write it?
Yes, he did. The Everly Brothers singing a Buddy Holly melody, I think. I think that's one of the reasons that country music has become more popular is that a lot of young country artists coming up are very much influenced by rock, so there's a lot more. It's not as if listeners think, oh, I don't like country music. It's too southern. It's too something like that. There's a lot more kind of mainstream influence in it that I think is much more appealing to people nowadays.
Ken, let's take a break, and then we'll talk some more and play some more records. Ken Tucker is with us, Fresh Air rock critic, and he's playing for us some of his favorite records of 1991. This is Fresh Air. Back with rock critic Ken Tucker, who's brought with him some of his favorite records of the year. Let's talk a little bit about what happened in rap in 1991. Is it my imagination, or is it starting to genuinely sound a little bit alike? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think so.
Where's rap going to go next? I don't know.
I don't know. I don't think there have been as many interesting rap records this year as there were in the previous year. I think to a certain extent the style is ossified to a... And I think that right now what rap is kind of working through its system is its shock tactics, that still a lot of the big rap records were records that had a lot of obscenity, a lot of shock for shock's sake. That's why something like N.W.A. or the Ghetto Boys get a lot of attention, which is not to say that these groups are without talent either. But there were no big stylistic advances. I still think that Public Enemy put out the best rap record of the year. I've thought this in years past. This is their fourth album now. To me, the production group that the Public Enemy works with, called the Bomb Squad, has this kind of density and complexity to its sound that is really unmatched in any other kind of rap music that I find pretty fascinating.
So what are you going to play for us?
The album was called Apocalypse 91, The Enemy Strikes Black. And the song that I really think is terrific is called Night Train. And if you listen to it, what you're going to hear is a bit of James Brown's old song, Night Train, kind of worked into this. And I think it's a rap song that's deeply influenced by the blues. It's really interesting.
Get to the birds, man. Man of the free, but the skin I'm in, I don't. train ride. Talk about raw hardcore, leaving frauds on the outside. But the bad thing is anyone can ride the train. And the reason for that is because we look the same. Looking all around at my so-called friends. Light skin to the brown, the black. Here we go again. Homie over there knows keeping. But he be thieving. I don't trust him. Better bust him up. Out goes his hand and I call him. He was stolen from me. Yeah, I want to cut it off. The black thing is around. I call him night train. He rides the good, the bad. We call him monkey train. Train to attack the black. And it's true. Because I'm a lamb looking just like you.
If you're just joining us, my guest is rock critic Ken Tucker, and he's playing for us some of his favorite records of 1991. Now, I can see from your list here that one of your favorites is somebody who's pretty new, singer-songwriter.
Yeah, Matthew Sweet. He's only put out about two or three records, had fairly a low profile until now. He used to be in a band called Golden Palominos, which was sort of a group of New York rockers that... very arty kind of things. But he's put out this record called Girlfriend that is really terrific. Sweet himself has this very sort of delicate, reedy voice. And on this record, he contrasts his own singing and songwriting with the guitar playing of Robert Quine, who's done stuff with Lou Reed, and Richard Lloyd, who came up with Television in the late 70s. These really strong, loud guitar players. And I think that the contrast between Sweet singing and these guitars makes for a really interesting record. It's not a kind of wimpy pop singer-songwriter record. The cut I'd like to play is a song called Divine Intervention that I think you'll hear right away is this very heavily influenced by the Beatles.
Every year there's some really good records that fall through the cracks because they don't get played on commercial radio. And what's your choice for one of those this year?
Yeah, I think that the best of those was Marshall Crenshaw's record, Life's Too Short. I mean, this was a record whose own life was too short. I don't know why. I mean, it seemed to me that almost every single song here had really strong melody and great vocal by Marshall Crenshaw. And I think, to a certain extent, I think that he might be an example of someone who has now been around for about 10 years, and it's difficult for the industry to get enthusiastic and to get behind a record like this. It's almost as if the audience is irrelevant to the success of a record like this without radio playing it and critics writing about it. And all of a sudden, everybody within the music industry says, oh, yeah, he's a nice guy, but, you know, he's over. And I think that that's a terrible thing. And it's too bad that an audience can't connect with a Marshall Crenshaw.
Well, rock critic Ken Tucker is with us with his choices of some of the best records of 1991. Ken, let me ask you to run through your list. And I should say, it's not a top 10. There's not exactly 10 on here.
That's right.
But it is a list.
That's right. Yeah, I couldn't really come up with a full 10 this year. It was difficult. There are a lot of good singles around. But anyway, the albums, that Marshall Crenshaw record, Life's Too Short, the Nirvana record, Nevermind, the Public Enemy record, Apocalypse 91, and certainly Matthew Sweet, which is called Girlfriend. I also thought that Bonnie Raitt's record, Luck of the Draw, was really good. I mean, just as strong as the record last year that was sort of her big commercial breakthrough. I mean, I think it was very brave of her to pursue these kinds of very bluesy songs. She could have gone in a real pop direction and tried to appeal to those fans that she brought in on the last record, but she didn't. I thought that was really good. Alexander O'Neill put out a record called All True Man, which I think is sort of the R&B overlooked album of the year. That title song, to me, sounded like an unbelievable hit, which didn't quite make it. Alexander O'Neill, somebody from Minneapolis who's had great success in England, not much success here. Let's see. Willie Nelson put out a record called Who'll Buy My Memories, which I think is wonderful. It's just an album of Willie Nelson and his acoustic guitar. He recorded the album to pay off the debt to the owed to the IRS. And you'd think that this would be this cynical, cheapy throwaway, like just something he tossed off to get out and pay some money, pay some bills. And actually, it's incredibly moving. He went back to a lot of songs that he wrote and recorded in the late 50s and early 60s. Most songs would be completely unknown to even people who consider themselves Willie Nelson fans now. And most of them are very slow. I mean, it's a very depressing, but wonderfully depressing record. It's really good. Another country album I liked a lot was Patti Loveless's Up Against My Heart. I thought this was like the female country ballad album of the year, really strong singing. And finally, a girl group called Voice of the Beehive. It's their follow-up to their debut album, which was called Let It Be, and this was called Honey Lingers. It's just really nice pop music. It's really good record.
What about singles?
I thought it was a really good year for singles. Everything from big, really big hits like I Touch Myself by the Divinyls, which I really think is the wonderful, scandalous record of the year, to Luther Vandross, I thought put out a really good record, which was called Power of Love, Love Power, kind of two songs that he sort of made joined together. R.E.M.'s Losing My Religion, I didn't much care for the entire album they put out this year, but I thought Losing My Religion was a really terrific song. I tend to like a lot of stuff that's on the radio as opposed to more obscure singles, stuff that really catches my ear, although I wouldn't want to sit down and listen to an entire album of, say, something like CNC Music Factory. I think that their single, Gonna Make You Sweat, is just a really terrific dance record. Even someone who I normally despise, like Amy Grant, I thought Baby Baby was a really terrific pop song. I could listen to that. You know, anytime that came on the radio, I'd just crank that up and think, geez, that's Amy Grant.
She's the big Christian music crossover story.
Yeah, and usually puts out these terribly drippy, drippy records, but I thought this was really good. Another country single by a guy named Marty Stewart called Tempted was really good. And EMF, there's a song called Unbelievable, which I thought there were a lot of these sort of whiny, bored-sounding English sort of acts around this year, and that EMF song was one of the few that I could really not only stand but really get enthusiastic about. And finally, another song by a group called High Five. The song was called I Like the Way, The Kissing Game, which was just a really nice, pretty R&B ballad, I thought.
Well, Ken, thanks a lot for reviewing the year in rock music for us.
Well, thanks, and a Happy New Year to you.
Oh, thanks, Ken. Happy New Year to you. Ken Tucker is Fresh Air's rock critic, and he writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. This year, real life preempted a lot of TV programs. We watched the Gulf War, the Soviet coup, and the Clarence Thomas hearings. Coming up, TV critic David Bianculli reviews the year on TV. Also, it's smelly, noisy, and often dangerous, but it gets you where you want to go, usually. Maureen Carrigan reviews a book and a photography show about the New York City subway system. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Bush today said he'd like to meet with Russian President Boris Yeltsin before too long, now that the Soviet Union has collapsed. NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
A day after Mr. Bush announced the establishment of diplomatic relations with Russia and many of the other former Soviet republics, the president said he was satisfied with the controls those new states have placed on nuclear weapons. And he predicted the United States would have good relations with the Commonwealth of Independent States because, he said, they no longer view the U.S. as the enemy. Speaking at a White House news conference, Mr. Bush said he has spoken to Boris Yeltsin about a meeting, although nothing has been planned yet.
President Yeltsin and I have been in close touch, will continue to be, but I would say that a meeting before too long is important, and I think he agrees with that.
In an effort to help the newly formed Commonwealth nations, the United States plans to sponsor an international conference in January to discuss and coordinate aid programs. I'm Andy Bowers in Washington.
An official in Tbilisi, the Georgian capital, says a five-day-old battle for control of the republic's parliament building has stopped. Forces loyal to President Zviad Gamzakuria and the opposition fighters have been battling for political control. The opposition is demanding the resignation of Gamzakuria, who they claim is a dictator. More than 40 people have been reported killed and 260 wounded in the fighting. The new Serbian prime minister has warned that the war in Croatia could spread unless the United Nations takes steps to prevent Germany and other countries from establishing diplomatic ties with the former Yugoslav republics. Pierre Vickery reports the prime minister called for the immediate deployment of the UN peacekeeping force in Yugoslavia.
Radovan Bojovic accused the United Nations of remaining inactive in the face of the deepening Yugoslav state crisis and warned that the current fighting in Croatia would probably spread to the ethnically mixed Republic of Bosnia unless immediate action was taken. The Serbian Prime Minister claimed that Serbia was not at war with Croatia and was merely providing political assistance to the Yugoslav army. He admitted that the war made rational economic policy impossible and predicted that hyperinflation, mass unemployment, and drastically reduced production would continue until the conflict was settled. Meanwhile, heavy fighting continues in parts of central and eastern Croatia. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
The Israeli army says it blew up a house in southern Lebanon today that allegedly served as a base for Arab guerrillas. The house was near Yatar, a village just north of Israel's self-declared security zone in south Lebanon. Israeli Army Radio said no one was in the house when it was demolished. Israel's been trying to push Shiite Muslim guerrillas out of villages north of the security zone. On Wall Street, the stock market closed at a record high. The Dow gained nearly 32 points to finish the day at 3082.96. This is NPR. Reports from Delhi, India, say gunmen shot and killed at least 55 passengers on a train in Punjab today. State television said the assailants boarded the train in Punjab and opened fire when it stopped at Ludhiana, an industrial town nearly 200 miles northwest of Delhi. No motive has been revealed for the attack, nor has anyone claimed responsibility for the incident. Police do suspect Sikh separatists who are thought to have killed 3,500 people this year. The separatists want an independent Sikh homeland in Punjab. A new presidential primary poll shows a tight race in New Hampshire between two Democrats and fairly strong numbers for President Bush. From New Hampshire Public Radio, Martin Murray reports.
The poll by American Research Group of Manchester shows Democrats Paul Tsongas and Bill Clinton virtually tied, each with about 20% of the vote. Bob Kerry drew 9%, Tom Harkin 3%, Doug Wilder 1%, Jerry Brown none. Over 40% of Democrats polled were undecided. President Bush is favored by almost 60% of the Republicans polled. 20% are undecided. The rest favor Pat Buchanan. Former White House Chief of Staff John Sununu today announced he'll be part of the president's reelection campaign in New Hampshire. The poll has a margin of error of plus or minus 5%. For National Public Radio, I'm Martin Murray in Concord, New Hampshire.
The United Nations Secretary General Javier Pérez de Cuellar today said he hopes the body of American hostage William Buckley will be returned by this weekend. But Germany's efforts to free the two remaining German hostages from Lebanon seem to receive a setback today. The kidnapper said they would not release the men until two Shiite Muslim brothers jailed in Frankfurt are also released. Mohammed and Abbas Hamadi were convicted of committing separate terrorist acts. It's believed that members of the Hamadi family are holding German relief workers Thomas Kempner and Heinrich Strubig. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. We're asking some of our critics to look back on the year 1991. David Bianculli spent much of the year, as he usually does, sitting in front of his TV, or should I say his TVs. Let's see if our TV critic thought it was a good year for television.
It was a good year on TV for nonfiction, for real news, and it was a lousy year on TV for fiction. I mean, creatively, this is the most depressing TV year, I think, in a decade, and not this decade either.
And you're pretty charitable, usually.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I'm surprised you still let me in after all these years. But it's just I was very disappointed by the mid-season because there wasn't anything creatively that was good there, and there wasn't anything in the fall season. So we went a whole year without anything good. But you look at the real news. You look at the air war, the ground war, the Russian Revolution, the Clarence Thomas hearings, the William Kennedy Smith. I mean, that's almost a top 10 of television right there, and some of those were very significant and riveting, and others were somewhat less significant but still riveting.
Do you think that's changed the way we use TV this year?
Well, we always use TV like that when items like that come up, but it just seemed like so many of them came up. That's an average of one every 2 months, and some of them really drove home how important TV is and how important it can be. And it was, you know, I mean, for me, you know, writing on Deadline and writing different stuff on each edition at the start of the ground war was a real challenge and a real thrill. I mean, it was also very scary. And, you know, the night that we thought that everybody was making mistakes and that was going to be the end of it, thanks to the bombing of Israel.
Yeah, I agree that some of the most gripping TV has been coverage of real events, but this is happening simultaneous with budget cutbacks in the news departments at all the networks. But I think the networks are realizing that this is where it's at in terms of what's interesting now and what people are turning to TV for. So do you know what's happening behind the scenes?
Well,
I
still don't think they've made the right decisions. They're still cutting back in areas where they shouldn't. They're still cutting a little bit too deep. They're cutting on the things that don't show up on the air, figuring that they aren't important. They're cutting back on researchers. They're cutting back on depth of crewmen. They're cutting back on bureaus and bureau chiefs and reporters around the world. So when something happens, not only do they not know enough about what it is, they can't get the information quickly enough, and they don't have anybody in place that can do anything more than just drop in and do superficial stuff. I mean, that's not true in every city around the world, but it's true enough that we don't know the coverage we're not getting, except that you can just sort of sense that what we're getting is not as good as what we could get in most circumstances.
Well, although you think it's been a pretty shabby year for fiction TV, what are some of the new series, if any, that you've enjoyed?
This season, the ones that came around in the fall starting in September, there's I'll Fly Away, which is the examination of the civil rights era, and Sam Waterston is just such a good actor, and they're actually it's a very good cast, and that one works out okay for me, even though it's not one of these that I have to watch every week, which is how I gauge whether a show is a favorite of mine. Brooklyn Bridge is on the border. That's another period show, but that's about growing up in Brooklyn in the 50s. And that, again, is a show that if I'm watching television and it's on, I will gladly and gratefully watch it, but I will not go out of my way to seek it just yet. And Rock, which I was excited about at the beginning of the season, that's a Fox show, has been kind of uneven lately, so I don't know how that's going to end up its season. But that's a pretty paltry list. And a lot of my favorites from last year, I mean, are all just down the TV tube, so to speak. I mean, 30-something and China Beach and Twin Peaks and Equal Justice and even The Flash, which I liked.
So you think this
Aren't you glad to be associated with me? Even The Flash.
So you think this is a year more notable for good programs taken off the air than for good programs newly arriving on the air?
Yeah. I mean, the talk last year was, you know, Twin Peaks was going to change television because it was different and people were in search of different. The networks finally decided that not enough people were in search of different, so they would go back to same. But there aren't enough people watching the same, so now the networks don't know what to do at all. I mean, they tried bringing back all the old people from all the old series and all the old formats. The most maddening thing about TV this year is that you might as well be watching 70s television. I mean, so P.S. I Love You, if you look at that, I would defy you to tell me what decade we're in. You know, it's an amazing, timeless sort of bad, heart-to-heart Charlie's Angels kind of series.
The giveaway would be that they weren't wearing those big sideburns.
Yeah, I guess no leisure suits. Yeah.
Well, what about on cable? Anything interesting happening on cable this year?
The most interesting things are happening on cable. I mean, the networks almost by default are allowing them to do that. But here again, you've got Dream On, mm-hmm. which is a very... I liked that show an awful lot. It was basically using old clips from 50s TV and interspersing them in a regular kind of situation comedy format. There was Sessions, the Billy Crystal comedy starring Michael McKean, which took a rather adult look at psychoanalysis and was pretty funny and sometimes very insightful. And then Tales from the Crypt, which, to praise it, all I have to say is that it's everything that the EC comic book was in the 50s. It's full of bad puns. Now, I don't know why you would think that that would appeal to me. But, you know, I mean, grisly visual humor and some good frights, some good laughs. It's perfect.
I want to put in a word for In Living Color, which I think is inconsistent, but is often mm-hmm. so good. Do you get to watch that?
Yes. No, I watch that a lot. I like In Living Color so much because it reminds me of a high school performing arts group with an awful lot of talent. I mean, that's what I think is uneven about it. Sometimes the skits don't work, but whether they work or not, you always see them enjoying the acting, and yet sometimes you get that shockwave of recognition from the studio audience and when you're watching at home, it's seeing something there that you haven't seen anywhere else. I mean, I was amazed, you know, with the men on film
mm-hmm.
and the snaps up. I mean, that to me was very, very funny from the very beginning when it could have been offensive to a lot of groups, but it was just so well delineated. But I had no idea how true it was until like 2 years later on POV, on PBS, Tongues Untied, there were all these gay black guys talking about snaps and showing different kinds of snaps. And I was like stunned to realize that I was just this, you know, middle-aged white guy that had no idea that there was a full basis of reality. But it gives you a lot of trust for that show.
Middle-aged straight white guy.
Yeah.
And if you're just joining us, my guest is TV critic David Bianculli. We're running down the year in television, a year that David is not wildly enthusiastic about. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. TV critic David Bianculli is with us to review the year in television. You know what I think this has really been the year of?
Hmm.
The infomercial.
Oh, yeah.
It's amazing. Sunday morning, Saturday morning, they're just
Sunday
all...
night. Sunday night. Yes. Sunday night. And even dead people. I mean, Michael Landon. Michael Landon is still selling.
I find that so offensive, don't you?
Yeah.
I mean, not that... Not...
I found it offensive when he was alive.
Yeah.
I mean, if Michael Landon teaching me math. I don't mean to speak ill of Michael Landon, but I've met the guy, and I did not think of him as any sort of a mathematics scholar. He's selling Be Very Smart at Math, and Here's a Way That You Can Remember. And I would rather watch Jaime Escalante on public television, who teaches little tricks like that. I mean, my children and I can now multiply almost any number by 11 in our heads very easily, but it doesn't just come up often in conversation.
Do you know why so many of the network affiliates are selling their time to infomercials? It seems to me that this year there was really a big increase in the number of infomercials on network affiliate stations where I live in Philadelphia, and they might call up and say that's not true, but that's the way it's appeared to me.
It really has grown geometrically, and they're on in late nighttime slots and early morning time slots, so they're on in periods where the audience build is not important at all. I mean, they're not worried about keeping an audience, you know, past an infomercial.
What's in it for the network affiliates or for any station?
Free money, right off. I mean, they don't have to worry about selling, you know, they don't have to, in this economy, they know it's money coming in. You know, it's not barter, it's no problem, it's just there, it's over the transom.
Because the infomercial producers buy the whole half hour.
Right.
Public TV. Anything interesting happening? Anything interesting happen this year on public TV?
Well, public television spent the whole year trying to do the Civil War again. You know, trying to find another Civil War, another big hit. They stripped a lot of shows across the board. They pumped a lot of energy and a lot of publicity, a lot of promotion into a lot of shows that were not as good. But on the other hand, it also did some of the best television of the year. Any public television series with American in the title is worth watching. I mean, American Experience, the documentaries they've been doing this year are incredible. And American Playhouse, most of the things that they've done this year are excellent. American Experience, Frontline. Frontline did like 5 or 6 or 7 documentaries in a row that were so good that I had to review them as my major day story in the New York Post. And, I would come back and say, this is what I want to write about for tomorrow. And it almost got to be like, oh, not Frontline again, not American Experience again. But they were so far above anything else that was being offered, it was no contest.
Well, let's look ahead to 1992. Anything you're looking forward to?
Nothing yet.
Oh, great.
I mean, what I'm looking forward to is a better year for me. But as I flip my little calendar, here's a nice little oral aid. You can hear me flip the calendar to 91 or 92. There's nothing really exciting coming up. At least that they've, unless a show called Tequila and Bonetti sounds groundbreaking to you. It's better than the original title, which was Tequila and Boner. I think it was about a cop and his dog, and they changed it to a cop and an Italian. I don't even have the urge to really be up on some of these things anymore. But I'll find, you know, they'll get to me sooner or later. But no, it's not a... I assume that if they learn the lessons that in 91 that nothing good happened dramatically, that maybe they'll do something better in 92 and hope that there's this sort of a pendulum. But the networks are losing more and more money, and, you know, we may not even have all four networks by the time we get to the end of 92.
You know, you've been talking about how interesting nonfiction TV was this year. Do you have any idea what the networks plan on doing in terms of their campaign coverage of the presidential campaign?
Yeah, I think they're going to do some things a little bit differently. You're going to see on newscasts them, rather than just taking straight news feeds or photo opportunities, they're going to take them and show them because, of course, that's their business. But they're also going to allow their specialists and reporters to analyze them and to talk about how the people are trying to manipulate the media, and in so pointing them out, hopefully having them fail in that attempt. That's one thing. Another thing is that you're going to see, I think, a very strong focus on analyzing paid political advertisements as they come out so that they will also be considered newsworthy. But on news programs, they'll show portions of the advertisements, and then they'll talk about the claims that aren't really true, or they'll get other people on to refute them and sort of insert a checks and balances kind of thing to the whole system. I think that's great. I don't think they've solved the debate idea yet, though.
Why not?
It's still way too structured. Don Hewitt of 60 Minutes had an idea a couple years ago to just throw a Democratic team and a Republican team in a room and let them have at it, so that if one person said something, another person could say, well, no, that's not true, and then come up and just do it almost, like a real solid debate rather than, you know, tiny little mini filibusters.
So you're suggesting the TV news reporters are going to be standing back and analyzing more and not just accepting photo opportunities. Do you think that they feel that they've been used?
Oh, sure. Well, they better feel. I mean, I hope that they're intelligent enough to know that they've been used. I mean, but I think that what's happening now is that they are giving the audience credit enough to know that they are being used, that the politicians are trying to use them. And if they take it one more step and do stories about, here is how they are trying to use us, it sounds confusing, but it's really quite clever and clear. And I think that intelligent viewers will appreciate that sort of commentary and analysis.
Well, David, I hope you have a very good year.
Oh, mine's going to be a good one. The TV is bad. I don't have to watch it as much.
Fun to have you here today. Thanks for coming.
David
Bianculli is TV critic for Fresh Air and the New York Post. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Well, Noah, what do you have on this first official full day of the post-Gorbachev era?
Several things, and including a conversation with Nancy Lubin, who is a professor of Soviet affairs at Carnegie Mellon University. She talks with us about the Central Asian republics in the former Soviet Union, warning that if bastions of communism remain there, it's likely to be in Central Asia, especially if the economy gets worse. Also, Tom Jelton reports on new repression of artists and intellectuals in Romania. Renee Montaigne from South Africa on the tactics and hopes of the extreme white right in that country. And I'll have a conversation with Glenn Velez. He plays frame drums.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Some people call New York City's subway system the eighth wonder of the world. It runs 24 hours a day, and its 731 miles of track extend into almost every corner of the city. But critics say the real wonder of the New York subway is that anyone who rides it ever gets to their destination in one piece. Two recent considerations of the New York subway probe its glories and its terrors. An exhibit of subway photos by Walker Evans is now on view at the National Gallery in Washington, D.C. The photos have also been collected in a book. And New York Newsday columnist Jim Dwyer has a new book entitled Subway Lives. Maureen Carrigan saw the exhibit, read the book, and has these thoughts.
At the beginning of Subway Lives, Jim Dwyer says he considered centering his story inside the headquarters of the New York City Transit Authority. There's a room there called the Command Center. It contains a 70-foot-long electronic model board of the subway system. You imagine officials working here through the night, charting the course of each train as intently as Churchill's staffers charted the Battle of the Atlantic. There's only one hitch. The model board doesn't work. New York City ran out of the money to connect it to the actual tracks. One Transit Authority director confesses to Dwyer, "We don't know where most of the trains are at any given moment." This image of the dummy command center captures all the terror, chutzpah, and looniness of New York's subway system. There's no God's eye view of the subway because there's no subway god or public official who's watching over the chaos. Dwyer, therefore, decides to investigate the subway by focusing on its passengers. he constructs a riveting composite day in the life of the subway by tracing the train rides of seven New Yorkers. These are ordinary working stiffs, but because they ride the subway, their everyday commutes are as heroic as Orpheus's descent into the underworld. There's Joyce Brezza, who works at an exclusive Manhattan department store. She gets stuck underground for hours on a stalled train without lights or ventilation. Some of her fellow passengers panic and jump onto the tracks, risking electrocution. Kathy Keelace gives birth to a baby boy on another stalled train as other passengers play labor coach. We learn about subway thieves who literally suck tokens out of turnstile boxes. And Dwyer also squeezes in an encapsulated history of the 87-year-old subway system. My only objection to Subway Lives is that Dwyer's cast of characters is too schematic. The noble conductor, the tough kid from Brooklyn, the beautiful woman who needs rescuing. It sounds like the cast of Die Hard 3, but then maybe any book about the subway would sound like a disaster movie. If you think that the New York City subway must have been a cheerier place in the good old days, one look at subway photos by Walker Evans will shake you out of your sentimentality. In 1938, Evans hid a camera under his overcoat and went down into the subways. He photographed unsuspecting passengers over a four-year period. Evans said that he wanted to catch people in the naked repose that the limbo of the subway encourages. The faces in these 33 black and white photos all share the subway stare, the same look Dracula's victims got on their face right after they became blood donors. It's clear that the primordial rule of the subways has always been, "Thou shalt not make eye contact." In one group photo, a woman hides behind a newspaper, a man zones out into the distance, and even a little girl studies dust motes in the air. Apart from the fedoras on the men and the fur stoles on the women, these photos seem less dated than others from the same period where subjects have arranged their faces in Andrew Sister smiles. Evans' photos show us that the subway stare transcends time. Any of these people could board the IRT today, sit down, and fit right in. I guarantee you, no one in the New York subway would dare give them a second glance.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. Walker Evans' subway photos are on exhibit at the National Gallery in Washington through March 1st. Jim Dwyer's book is called Subway Lives. Fresh Air's reviews and interviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person, with Joan Tuohy, Roberta Shurrock, and Sue Spolin. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and is performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with James Toback about writing the screenplay for the new movie Bugsy. He wrote a lot of it in the gangster's old hotel suite in Las Vegas. Also, if you're looking for videos to rent for New Year's Eve, Peter Rayner has some overlooked films that he recommends. That and more coming up on the next Fresh Air.
Tomorrow, Friday, mostly sunny, the high 43.